Brothers in the Dharma, thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One dwelt at Rajagaha, on the hill called Vulture's Peak. At that time the king of Magadha, Ajatasattu, desired to wage war against the Vajis. He spoke in this fashion: "These Vajis, powerful and glorious as they are, I shall annihilate them. I shall make them perish. I shall utterly destroy them." And Ajatasattu, the king of Magadha, addressed his chief minister, the Brahmin Vasakara, saying, "Come, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One, pay homage in my name at his feet. Wish him good health, strength, ease, vigour and comfort, and speak thus: O Lord, Ajatasattu, the king of Magadha, desires to wage war against the Vajis. He has spoken in this fashion: These Vajis, powerful and glorious as they are, I shall annihilate them. I shall make them perish. I shall utterly destroy them. And whatever the Blessed One should answer you, keep it well in mind and inform me, for the Tathagatas do not speak falsely." So opens the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the 16th and longest discourse of the Digya Nikaya, the longest text of the Pali Canon, the older text of Buddhism. And it's a text that tells the story of the last days of the Buddha, the final 3 months in particular of the Buddha's life. And as we heard last night, it's a very beautiful and interesting sutta. It's very clear and concise, and it's blessedly free of a lot of the repetition you get in other Pali texts. Though not completely free, and you do get lots of lists as well, but it's still very readable. And at times it's a very funny sutta. There's a lot of amusing incidents that are there to be read. And again, it's very readable and very approachable. So it's a really good place to start if you want to start reading some primary Pali texts. There's many good translations available. There's a couple of copies of this up in the bookshop called The Last Days of the Buddha, the best £2.95 you'll ever spend. And it's free on the Access to Insight website. So if anything grabs you about the sutta, I'd really encourage you to go and read it. And the story itself is very simple in some ways. The Buddha is now an old man of 80 years old, and he's approaching his death. And he's faithfully accompanied by his friend and attendant and companion Ananda. And he makes one final journey before dying and being cremated in Kushinara. And while it's a very simple story, it's a tremendously rich story as well, full of emotion and celebration and sadness and poignancy. It's primarily a story of two men. Firstly, the Buddha, a man but more than a man. And one of the great things about this sutta is that it really communicates in a way, the humanity of the Buddha, the down-to-earthness of the Buddha. He's an old man, stiff and sore, and not as physically energetic as he would have been in his earlier days. You see him racked by illness and needing help and assistance from Ananda and the other disciples. And not just that, you also get a sense of the emotional life of the Buddha. You see the delight he takes in things. You see how he behaves in the world, and you get a sense of the real emotional life of the Buddha. And you get a sense of what it would be like to be in the flesh and blood presence of the Buddha. I find the later Mahayana texts are awe-inspiring, but often lose touch with this here and now flesh and blood sense of the Buddha that you get very clearly in this sutta. But while you see the humanity of the Buddha, you also very clearly see the transcendent nature of the Buddha. So he was a man, but he was also more than a man. He was an enlightened man. And even though he suffers all the decrepitude of old age and sickness, he continuously throughout the sutta manifests a sense of something more, a sense of something more than being just human, a sense of something indefinable, a deep wisdom that goes beyond mere humanity, that goes beyond even the other enlightened disciples in the sutta. So the Buddha is the first main character of the sutta. The second main character is Ananda, the much beloved Ananda. And Ananda is the Buddha's cousin, and he's the Buddha's closest attendant, and he's a very close friend for many years. And while he's not enlightened, he describes himself as a beginner, but in fact he's a stream entrant and has gained some measure of irreversible insight. And Ananda is very important in the text. He's the Buddha's constant companion, but in a way, I find through reading the sutta, it's nearly like we are Ananda in the text walking with the Buddha in his final days. Ananda displays the kinds of emotions that I would probably display if I was walking with the Buddha in his final times. At times he's blithely unaware of what's going on. At times he's deeply clingy. At times he's very distraught as to the Buddha's impending death. At times he's inspired by the Buddha. And after the Buddha's death, he mourns deeply the loss of his great friend and companion. And Ananda was well known in his day for his great kindness. And perhaps one of his great kindnesses to us in this sutta is that he allows us to enter into him and walk with the Buddha through him. So he's a very important character in the sutta as well as the Buddha. So the sutta is the story of these two men walking towards the Parinibbana. And quite importantly also, it's the story of the deep friendship that you see embodied in these two men, who have been close companions now for 25 years. So what I'd like to do is just take us through the sutta. It's more of a storytelling than a talk in some ways. So I'll talk us through the sutta. It's a long text, so I won't be going into all the details. And if there's anything that grabs you that I haven't unpacked very much, do chat to the study leaders later on in the groups. I've given the study leaders notes as to some of the lists that will come up, so don't break your hand trying to write down the seven this or the eight that. You can ask the study leader later on. So as you've heard, the sutta opens in a dramatic and almost Tarantino-esque fashion with the bloodthirsty king Ajatasattu vowing to annihilate and destroy the neighbouring Vajjayan Federation. And this was the king who imprisoned and murdered his own father to gain the throne. And believe it or not, he was a supporter and a patron of the Buddha and would visit him. But he was in the process as well of creating a vast empire across India. And he sends his minister to the Buddha for advice as to how his chances of success are. And already it gives you a sense of the kind of tricky political questions that the Buddha would have had to face in his own time. And the Buddha, who knows the Vajjis, who Ajatasattu wants to conquer, asks a series of questions of Ananda. And he asks such questions as, well, do they have frequent gatherings? Are their meetings well attended? Do they assemble and disperse peacefully and attend to their affairs in concord? Do they show respect, honour and esteem and veneration towards their elders and think it worthy to listen to them? Do they refrain from abducting women and maidens of good family and from detaining them, and so on? And these conditions are called the seven conditions of the nation's welfare. And the Buddha says that as long as they practice these seven conditions, the growth of their society is to be expected, not their decline. And Ananda replies that they do satisfy these seven conditions. And so Ajatasattu's campaign will not be successful. And the Buddha and Ajatasattu thanks the Buddha and departs. Now subsequently, it doesn't say this in the sutta, but subsequently Ajatasattu spends great resources sowing discord among the Vajjis and succeeds in this and eventually conquers the Vajjis. But once the minister is gone, the Buddha then turns to his monks and he gives a further seven conditions, but this time the seven conditions which lead to the welfare of the Sangha, and they're quite similar to the ones for the welfare of society. I'll just read them out because they're very interesting. The growth of the bhikkhus, that is the Sangha of monks, is to be expected, not their decline, so long as they assemble frequently and in large numbers, meet and disperse peacefully, and attend to the affairs of the Sangha in concord, so long as they appoint no new rules and do not abolish the existing ones, but proceed in accordance with the code of training laid down, so long as they show respect, honour, esteem and veneration towards the elder bhikkhus, those of long standing, long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha, and think it worthwhile to listen to them, so long as they do not come under the power of craving that leads to a fresh becoming, so long as they cherish the forest depths for their dwellings, so long as they establish themselves in mindfulness, so that the virtuous brethren of the order who have not come yet might do so, and those already come might live in peace. So it's a wonderful list that we could probably spend the whole weekend on and more. And if you're curious as to how we can have a really good retreat together, well, if we all just live out those seven conditions, we'd have a very good retreat together. And indeed, we'd create a great Sangha together. And then the Buddha goes on to teach the seven good qualities, the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven perceptions, and the six conditions to be remembered. So you do get this sometimes in the Pali text, that as soon as eight of this or seven of that is mentioned, there's another seven and another seven and another seven tacked on. So I'm not sure if this is literally what the Buddha thought. Maybe it was added on for learning purposes. In some ways, they interrupt the flow of the sutra, though they're very interesting lists in their own right. And then the Buddha gives a very important teaching, which is repeated again and again throughout the sutta. And he gives this teaching both to lay people and to monks and nuns who are very advanced. And this profound teaching is this. This is ethics, this is meditation, this is wisdom. Great is the gain in meditation when it is supported by fully developed ethics. Great is the gain in wisdom when it is supported by fully developed meditation. When wisdom is fully developed, one is utterly freed from greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a teaching we've probably all heard, or at least come across if we've any encounters with Buddhism. Yet, it's a profound teaching. He gives it to these highly advanced practitioners. So it's quite saying something that this isn't a basic teaching. So it's good to bear it in mind. And again he gives this teaching throughout the course of the sutta. So to continue on the Buddha's journey, he then travels with Ananda to Nalanda, and he meets a large community of monks, which includes Sariputta, his foremost disciple. And Sariputta is an enlightened follower at this point. It's not long before his death, actually, himself. And him and the Buddha engage in some playful verbal sparring. You get the sense that they're having a bit of fun with each other. And Sariputra announces that there has not been, never in the history of the Dharma, nor will there ever be, nor is there now, a recluse more enlightened than the Buddha. And the Buddha exclaims that this is some statement. How can Sariputra be sure? Has he met all the liberated ones of the past? Has he met all the liberated ones of the present? Will he meet all the liberated ones of the future? How can he make such a lion's roar of a statement? And Sariputra has to admit that he hasn't, and he can't make such a statement. But suppose you were to have a fortified city with a strong wall around its entire boundary, and there was but one gate in that wall, and no hole in the wall so large that even a cat could slip through it. It's a fair bet then to say that any beings who enter that city have to go through the gate. And similarly, with all the enlightened ones, he might not know them all, but he can be sure that they all enter in through the gate of practicing, abandoning the five hindrances, cultivating the four foundations of mindfulness, and cultivating the seven factors of enlightenment. So in a way, he does know the enlightenment of all beings, because there's only one way to enlightenment: abandoning the hindrances, cultivating mindfulness, and cultivating the seven factors of enlightenment. And the Buddha, you get the sense, is pleased with this response. From here, the Buddha and Ananda go on to Patalagama, and here they're met with a large number of lay followers to whom the Buddha gives a teaching, the fruits of the immoral and moral life. In other words, a teaching on ethics. And he spends much of the night gladdening, rousing, edifying them. And this is something that he does again and again. He gladdens, rouses, inspires, edifies. And there's an important point here that as communicators of the Dharma, and if we're practicing the Dharma, we're all communicating the Dharma to some degree, it's really important to follow the Buddha's example and look to gladden and rouse and inspire people. Also in Patalagama, he notices that the town has been turned into a fortress by King Ajatasattu for the forthcoming war with the Vajis. And there's a curious incident here where the Buddha notes that there are many, many gods, devas, deities as they're called, or devas as they're called in the Pali texts, and there many of them are present. And where there are gatherings of gods of great power, there are also gatherings of men of great power. Where there are gods of medium and lesser power, men of lesser and medium power are too gathered there. So it's a curious incident. Maybe perhaps there's something we can tease out of that ourselves. Onwards they go to Kotagama, and he teaches ethics, meditation, and wisdom, and then on to Nadika. And here is another amusing incident. Ananda, who has a brilliant memory, a photographic memory, notes that many of the monks and nuns and lay people who were here the last time they came have since died. And he proceeds in a very traditional manner to ask the Buddha, well, where were they reborn? What was their rebirth like? And what was their spiritual attainments? And first of all, he lists off 12 people. And the Buddha answers each person in turn. It turns out they've all attained some degree of irreversible insight. And then just as you can imagine, Ananda's about to draw breath and asking for the next batch, and the next batch, and the next batch, because there's apparently 500 people who have died since they were last there. The Buddha then comments, truly, Ananda, it is nothing strange that human beings should die. But if each time it happens you should come to the Tathagata and ask him in this manner, indeed it would be troublesome to him. Therefore, Ananda, I will give you the teaching called the Mirror of the Dharma. And this teaching of the Mirror of the Dharma is how you know if someone has attained irreversible insight, has become, in other words, a stream entrant. You've become a stream entrant if you have unshakable faith in the Buddha as being enlightened, unshakable faith in the Dharma as leading to emancipation, unshakable faith in the Sangha as well-faring and worthy of honour and praise. And you also possess virtues dear to the enlightened ones. And then again, he gives the teaching, this is ethics, this is meditation, this is wisdom, and so on, and exhorts the followers there to live in mindfulness and with a clear sense of purpose. And again, then he meets the famous, he has the famous encounter with the celebrity courtesan Ambapali, who's a rich lay follower, who offers to feed all the monks. And she feeds all the Sangha, much to the chagrin of the beautiful dressed Lichavis, who were also hoping to invite the Buddha to dinner. And they end up snapping their fingers at her, claiming, we are defeated by this mango lass. So she wasn't well held up by other people. And again, to Ambapali and those present, he teaches ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Now, at this time, the rainy season started in India. And the tradition was at the time that the monks who would be normally homeless, would wander from place to place, would actually just settle in one place and have a retreat during the rainy season. And so the Buddha, so the monks dispersed, and the Buddha and Ananda stayed in the village of Beluva. And during this time, the Buddha experienced a severe illness. He was quite old, as I say. He was 80 years old or so. And it brought him very, very close to death, though he bore it mindfully and without being perturbed. And because he still had work to do to ensure the continuation of the Sangha, he suppressed his illness and lived on. And this incident leads to some really beautiful exchanges between the Buddha and Ananda. And Ananda was extremely worried at the Buddha's illness. And when he saw the Buddha recovering, he said, fortunate it is for me to see the Blessed One at ease again. Fortunate it is for me to see the Blessed One recovered. For truly, when I saw the Blessed One's sickness, it was as though my own body became weak as a creeper. Everything around became dim to me, and my senses failed me. And again, it's one of the times that I really identify with Ananda. If I was walking with the Buddha and the Buddha's about to die, I think I would feel weak at the knees as well. And then Ananda goes on to say, even though the Buddha was ill, he did have a feeling that the Buddha would not depart before giving last instructions to the Sangha. And then the Buddha utters a very heartfelt response. What more does the community of bhikkhus expect from me, Ananda? I have set forth the Dharma without making any distinction of esoteric and exoteric doctrine. There is nothing, Ananda, with regard to the teaching that the Tathagata holds to the last with a closed fist of a teacher who keeps something back. Now I am frail, Ananda, old, aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year, and my life is spent. Even as an old cart is held together with much difficulty, so my body is kept going only with supports. It is, Ananda, only when I, disregarding external objects, with the cessation of certain feelings, abide and attain in the signless concentration of mind, that my body is more comfortable. So in other words, he only experiences relief from the pain that his body is giving him when he is deeply absorbed in meditation and dwelling in the experience of nirvana. So he's an old, frail man whose body is falling apart. And he urges Ananda then as well that a monk, a Buddhist practitioner, should not depend upon the Buddha to practice, but rather be an island unto himself, a refuge unto himself, with no other refuge than the Dharma. Now, a few days later, the Buddha is more recovered, and they head into Vaishali for alms. And after doing so, they went to the beautiful Kapala shrine, which the Buddha greatly enjoyed and admired and appreciated the beauty of, along with other shrines of the area which were similarly beautiful. And by this time, interestingly, this was in the Vajjayan territory which Ajatasattu was looking to conquer. So it's interesting that the Buddha went to this place before the invasion did happen. And here another very curious incident occurs. The Buddha makes the unusual suggestion to Ananda that if a Buddha was requested to do so, he could choose not to die and instead stay until the end of the world to teach the Dharma. But unfortunately, Ananda doesn't notice and doesn't make the request of him. And again, a second time and a third time, the Buddha makes the statement. And again, Ananda doesn't do so. It doesn't occur to him to ask. And eventually Ananda takes his leave and sits under a tree some distance away. So I find it hard to make sense of this incident in some ways. Perhaps it's a later addition, or perhaps it's literally true. The traditional commentaries say that Mara, who's the embodiment of greed, hatred and delusion, of everything that holds us back, grasped the mind of Ananda and prevented him from asking. And Ananda does come in for some criticism later on from the Buddha himself, and after the Buddha's death, from other disciples for missing this. I do find it kind of sadly amusing, though, just how ditzy Ananda is here. And I do identify with him, particularly later on when he realizes his mistake and he has that experience. If only I could go back and change what happened. If only I could send a message back to myself. I had that experience last week after I made a big mistake. So if only I could go back and change that. So, but anyways, let's go on with the story. So then Mara appears. Mara, who, as I've said, is the embodiment of greed, hatred and delusion. And he reminds the Buddha that the Buddha has said that he would not die until the Sangha was set up and running well. And the Buddha has now done that. So Mara reminds the Buddha that the Buddha can pass away now. And the Buddha tells Mara not to worry. Before long, the Parinibbana of the Tathagata will come about. 3 months hence, the Tathagata will pass utterly away. And so the Buddha relinquishes the will to live. There are widespread earthquakes, and thunder rolls across the heavens. And Ananda returns to the Buddha, exclaiming, with an almost childish delight, how wonderful the earthquakes are, and asks the Buddha for their cause. The Buddha gives the 8 causes of earthquakes, one of which is that they happen when the Buddha relinquishes the will to live. And because there's a teaching on 8 good things, he also gives a teaching on the 8 kinds of assemblies, the 8 fields of mastery, and the 8 liberations. And then he gives the account of his encounter with Mara. And Ananda, again, realizing, as I said earlier, realizes his earlier mistake and is distraught and pleads with the Buddha to stay here and not die. But the time has passed, the Buddha said. The fault is with Ananda for not making the request earlier on. And I do find this a little hard to accept, but certainly the Buddha's next statement has a definite ring of truth to it. He says, "Yet, Ananda, have I not thought from the very beginning that with all that is dear and beloved, there must be change, separation, and severance? Of that which is born, come into being, is compounded and subject to decay, how can one say, may it not come to dissolution? There can be no such state of things." And so onwards they go, and he gives teachings on the foundations of mindfulness again, the Noble Eightfold Path, and he announces his Parinibbana in 3 months' time to the Sangha of monks. Now, shortly after that, the Buddha and Ananda leave Vaishali. And as they're leaving, the Buddha turns and takes a long look at Vaishali, commenting to Ananda that this would be the last time that the Buddha would look upon Vaishali with its beautiful shrines and places that the Buddha enjoyed so much over his life. So you get the sense of the Buddha again, the emotional life of the Buddha, taking in this place that he loved so much one last time before he walks to his death. And he goes on to Bandagama, to Hatigama, to Boganagara, and he teaches again ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And he also gives a teaching called the Four Alliances. And this is a teaching concerned with the monks after the Buddha's death. How can they be sure that a teaching that they hear is the true Dharma, is the true teaching of the Buddha? So you can see that he's very concerned, and again, you get this again and again, particularly from this point onwards, that he's very concerned with making sure the teaching is preserved, that the Sangha will survive after his own death. And in Pava, he accepts a last meal from Chunda, the metal worker, who's a wealthy metal worker who feeds the Buddha and his community of monks. And part of the food is something called Sukara Madhava. This translates literally as boar's softness. Perhaps pig's delight is a translation that I quite like. And it's not quite clear what this food is. There's been a lot of disagreement over what it is. Some people think it could be translated as tender pork. After all, the Buddha and his monks wouldn't necessarily have been vegetarian. They would have taken whatever was offered to them in their offering bowls. The condition was that they couldn't accept meat or flesh that was killed specifically for them. Other people think perhaps it's truffles, which pigs delight in. In any case, shortly afterwards, it seems the Buddha experiences food poisoning. Severe cramps and pains happen in his stomach, and he even suffers from dysentery. And he never really recovers from this illness, from the food. And slowly and painfully, he and Ananda make their way along the road to Kushinara, with the Buddha having to stop and rest from time to time, and with Ananda caring for him and helping him along the way. And there's a couple of minor miracles, and the Buddha manages to convert Pukkasa, who was a follower of Buddha's, of one of the Buddha's own teachers before the Buddha was enlightened. And in his delight, Pukkasa has two fine sets of golden robes made for Ananda and the Buddha. And when Ananda helps the Buddha to put on the robes, he notices, wonderful and all as the robes are, the Buddha's own skin shines even more brightly, even more golden than the robes themselves. And the Buddha explains that this is what happens, the Buddha, at the time of his enlightenment and on the night of his Parinibbana. And they continue on then towards Kushinara, and they're joined by a large gathering of monks. And the Buddha thoughtfully excuses Chunda from any disrepute, any criticism caused by his serving of the Buddha's meal. And in fact, he says it's an incredible honour to serve the Buddha food just before his enlightenment, and just after his enlightenment and just before the Parinibbana. So, and you do get these indications in the sutta that the Buddha seemed to consider the Parinibbana just as important as his enlightenment experience. So the Buddha continues on to his final resting place, the Malas Sala Grove, surrounded by the beautiful Sala trees near Kushinara. And with a large number of monks in attendance, he has his robe folded under him and he lies down to rest, as Padmavajra described last night. And the Sala trees around him, though not in season, spontaneously burst into blossom and shower him with beautiful flower petals. And further to this, Mandarava, heavenly flowers which only grow in the heavens, rain down upon him, and heavenly sandalwood incense billows around him, all to the chorus of music and songs of the gods who are gathered around as well as the monks, singing and praising the Buddha. And it's a very beautiful and iconic scene, very moving, all done in praise and veneration of the Buddha. But the Buddha says to Ananda, yet the best way of honouring a Buddha is to abide by the Dharma, live uprightly in the Dharma, and walk in the way of the Dharma. And here there's another amusing incident. The monk Upavana is standing before the Buddha, fanning him. He's a faithful servant of the Buddha for many years, and the Buddha asks him to move aside and not stand in front of him. And Ananda is puzzled by this. Why does the Buddha ask Upavana, who's served him so well for many years, tell him to get out of the way, basically? And the Buddha replies that throughout the tenfold world system, there are hardly any gods or goddesses, any devas, who have not gathered to look upon the Buddha. There's not even a spot that could be pricked by a tip of a hair that isn't full of these devas, and they've all come to see the Buddha's Parinibbana. And instead, right in front of the Buddha is this tattered and old monk. It's like someone complaining that you're standing in front of the television. So the Buddha asks him to move aside, and all the devas are afforded a ringside view of the Parinibbana. And like the humans, some of the devas are quite upset. They're wailing and weeping at the loss of the eye of the world, as they call the Buddha. And more of the more liberated ones are sitting calmly, reflecting upon impermanence. And now Ananda embarks upon a series of questions. Firstly, he asks, what will the monks do without the presence of the Buddha? What will they do without being able to have the Buddha in front of them? And the Buddha replies, famously, that they should go on pilgrimage to the four sites of Buddhism, the four holy sites of Buddhism, where the Buddha was born, where he was enlightened, where he set the wheel of the Dharma turning, and where the Parinibbana occurred. These are the most important four incidents in the Buddha's life. And people today still go on pilgrimage to these four sites. I'm sure many of you have. And there are various other questions that Ananda asks. He asks about how to dispose of the Buddha's body after death. And as we'll see, the Buddha is cremated in the manner of a universal monarch, a great king. And there comes then another famous incident involving Ananda. The death of the Buddha, the imminent death of the Buddha, hits Ananda very hard, and he is overcome with weeping and tears. And he goes outside and he goes some distance from the Buddha, and leaning against a doorpost, he exclaims, I am still but a learner, but alas, my master, who was so compassionate towards me, is about to pass away. And this is Ananda, who has spent 25 years with the Buddha at this point. And it's interesting how, of all the qualities of the Buddha, of all the many qualities of the Buddha, he rejoices in the Buddha's compassion. He rejoices in the Buddha's kindness. And our own teacher, Sangharakshita, has commented on this repeatedly, as a reminder for ourselves that metta, loving-kindness, is at the heart of the Buddha's enlightenment. Without loving-kindness, there's no wisdom. And great loving-kindness is how enlightenment will manifest in the world. And to emphasize this point, the Buddha notices Ananda's absence and calls him back and gives Ananda and rejoices in Ananda in front of all present. He rejoices in Ananda's devotion to the Buddha. He rejoices in his appropriateness in handling the Buddha's many meetings. He rejoices in how people are greatly joyful when they see Ananda. He rejoices in how when Ananda speaks the Dharma, people become joyful, and when he falls silent, people are disappointed. And perhaps a bit lifted by this, Ananda has one last go to try and convince the Buddha not to die, saying that this humble location isn't a suitable location for the Buddha to attain his Parinibbana. And you get the sense he's perhaps clutching at straws here now. But in any case, the Buddha reveals that in a former time, this place was a place of great glory, a palace of a universal monarch, a great king. And then Ananda is kept busy. The Buddha keeps Ananda busy by sending him off to tell the local people, the Malas, about the forthcoming Parinibbana. And the Mala people come, the Malas come in great numbers to pay homage to the Buddha. And this section of the sutta ends with the last convert, Subhadda, coming to see the Buddha. And Ananda is a bit too concerned with the Buddha's well-being and refuses him initially, but the Buddha overrides Ananda and invites Subhadda in. And Subhadda begins by asking about different teachers. Well, what do you think of this teacher? What do you think of that teacher? What does this guy do? Does he have something? And the Buddha replies, time being precious, he just says, enough, and gives him the true Dharma, gives him the teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path. And Subhadda asks for ordination into the Bhikkhu Sangha. And later on in his life, Subhadda himself, the last disciple of the Buddha, becomes an Arahant himself. Now, as I've said, you get the sense in the sutta that the Buddha is very concerned with the future preservation of the Sangha. And in his final moments, he turns his attention to making sure that the teaching is understood as well as possible. He makes some adjustments to the Vinaya and some comments. And then he asks, if anyone has any questions about the Dharma, about his teaching, to ask them now. And there is but silence. And then he thoughtfully asks if anyone would like to ask a friend to ask their question, if they're too embarrassed or nervous themselves. And again, there is but silence. And Ananda marvels at this and rejoices in this. But the Buddha says that he can see himself, that everyone there is actually a stream entrant. Everyone there has irreversible insight and so has no doubts about the Dharma. And then the Buddha utters his final words, all conditioned things are subject to change. All conditioned things are subject to change. With mindfulness, strive on. And rising true and coming down again through the superconscious states of dhyana, of meditative absorption, the Buddha then passes away. Throughout the eight world systems, a tremendous earthquake abounds and thunder rolls in the heavens. And the gods and beings of various places make various utterances, varying from deep comments about the nature of impermanence to wailing and lamenting at the loss of the eye of the world. And many of the less enlightened, the less attained bhikkhus around the Buddha also wail and lament the loss. And this goes on until Aniruddha, a disciple of great psychic powers, counsels them to cease, reminding them of impermanence and saying that their wailing is upsetting the devas. We have a saying in Ireland, I don't know if you have it here, if you're out with your mother and you're kind of embarrassing yourself or the family, she'd say, you're making a show of yourself. And you get the sense that Aniruddha is perhaps saying to the bhikkhus, you're making a show of yourself here, cop on. And you also perhaps, it does seem to happen now and again in the sutta that the less attained monks are on a riff about something, and almost to distract them, the Buddha or some other disciple will go, oh, look at the devas. And the monks go, ooh, tell us about the devas. So maybe that's what's going on as well. But perhaps as well, it's an important call for decorum. We should bear things nobly, particularly when we have the potential for setting an example for others. And obviously the bhikkhus would have great potential for setting an example for others. And the rest of the sutta then is concerned with the cremation and distribution of the Buddha's remains. And it's a part of this very old text that's actually very Mahayana in flavour, you could say. It's more Mahayana than the later Mahayana texts. It's very colourful and beautiful and celebratory. And first of all, for 6 days, the Malas, the people of the area, celebrate the Buddha with dance, song, music, flower garlands and perfume, erecting canopies and pavilions. And on the seventh day, they try to carry him to the place where he will be cremated, but they run into problems. They want to carry the body to the south of the town, where they will cremate him there. but the Devas have other ideas. They want to carry him to the north part of the town, then through the town and to a different part of the town for cremation. So they concede to the Devas' wishes, and suddenly all of the city of Kushinara is covered knee-deep in heavenly mandarava flowers. Even the rubbish heaps are covered with these wonderful and beautiful heavenly flowers. And with music and song and incense, both heavenly and man-made, the Buddha's body is carried through the city to the cremation spot. And here his body is wrapped in 500 double layers of linen and teased wool, and placed in a double iron container full of oil, and is placed upon a large pyre of fragranced wood and doused again with oil. And they try to set fire to it, but again the Devas get in the way, and they won't allow the pyre to catch fire. And the Devas hold up the show until a nearby group of monks, led by Mahakashyapa, one of the great enlightened leaders of the Buddha Sangha, have a chance to arrive. And once they arrive, the pyre spontaneously bursts into flame, and the Buddha's body is finally cremated. And the relics are gathered, the remains of the Buddha's body are gathered and are celebrated with another 7 days of worship, dance, music and song. And the sutta ends with the distribution of the Buddha's relics. And envoys from all the great rulers of the area all turn up. And after an initially tense standoff, they all agree to divide the relics up between them. And great stupas are built over these relics, and these are greatly honoured. And the sutta closes with an admonition to us, coming down through the ages from when the text was compiled. It says, "Pay homage with clasped hands, for hard indeed it is, through hundreds of ages, to meet with an all-enlightened one." So hard indeed it is to meet with an all-enlightened one, especially down through the ages, from the over 2,000 years since the Buddha walked this earth. But it is possible, hopefully, as we've seen, to get more of a sense of the Buddha through reading texts like the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. There are many ways to connect with the Buddha, and this is a very strong theme of the weekend. We'll be doing it through, well, you've just heard the Parinibbana Sutta, we're doing it through puja like last night and tonight. We'll be doing it in the recollection of the Buddha later on today. But Danny's going to talk a bit more tomorrow morning about how to connect with the Buddha in other ways. And perhaps the whole of Buddhist practice is about connecting with the Buddha, really. You could put the whole of Buddhist practice in the context of deepening our connection with the Buddha. And hopefully I've been able to give you a sense of through telling the story of the Buddha's last days and connecting with the Buddha. Again, I'd really recommend you to read the sutta yourself. And hopefully you've had more of a sense of the Buddha and his old friend and companion, Ananda, walking around the roads of northern India through the places they both knew and loved so well, walking for one last final time together. Hopefully you have a sense of the Buddha's human aspect, in particular, which can be seen in his aging and sore and failing old body, which was finally giving up on him. You have a sense of the Buddha's own inner emotional richness, visiting the places that he loved, that he'd seen many times in his life. Of the understandable grief and suffering of Ananda in the process of losing his teacher, his friend and his close companion. And you have a sense of the efforts that the Buddha went through to make sure that the Sangha would continue, the Dharma would continue as well after his death. And perhaps most of all, I hope we've been able to get a connection, able to see a bit more clearly the wisdom and kindness of this great, great figure, the Buddha Shakyamuni, who spent his life turning the wheel of the Dharma, the wheel of the Dharma which we are now experiencing and continuing to turn here this weekend, who attains his final release from the world of suffering, utterly liberated in all aspects in his Mahaparinibbana.